Hey, good morning, everybody. This is KWMR, 90.5 Point Reyes Station, 89.9 Bolinas, and 92.3 San Geronimo Valley. Coming up is a show that is my show, and Dallas' show, and Liz's show, the Westmore Naturalist Hour. We have a few messages before we get started. Go ahead, Liz.
Excellent. Good morning. KWMR is sponsored by the Point Reyes Lavender Company, offering locally grown lavender and lavender-based products online or at the Buddha Barn on Point Reyes Petaluma Road, Thursday through Sunday. Product and shipping information can be found at pointreyeslavender.com. That's pointreyeslavender.com. And media support for KWMR is provided by the Point Reyes Light, family-owned since 1948. Information on classified subscriptions, advertising, and more at ptreyeslight.com or at 415-669-1200.
Awesome. Let's play a little intro and be back in just a second. Okay, okie dokie, here we are. Well, hey, friends.
Hey.
How are we all doing?
Nice to have you back.
Yeah. I know, I missed the last show.
I know. We missed one or two buttons, but we did all right.
Well, I just missed a button myself, so, you know.
That's all right. Let's jump into the weather real fast. So, looks like the wind's actually going to stop this week for
finally.
Us.
Finally. It's been so windy.
I know. I've had enough of spring. So, summer's finally here. It looks like we're going to have temperatures in the mid-70s through the week with lows at nighttime in the 50s through the weekend. And then if you're heading out to the water, your tide's from Marshall, California. Your next low tide is 0.8 feet at 10:05 a.m. today. And our next high tide is 5.1 feet at 4:22. Now I'll pass it off to Liz to introduce today's guest.
Thanks, Dallas. Mm-hmm. We are very excited about our show today.
Yay!
Our guest Woo-hoo! Today is Dr. Megan Holst. She is a marine scientist and University of California Davis researcher studying sharks, rays, and skates in San Francisco Bay. She's working to characterize the bay as a critical reproductive area for elasmobranchs while identifying threats to these populations from contaminants and environmental stressors. Driven by a commitment to inclusive science, she co-founded Ocean Science Expedition Academy, OC, a nonprofit sustaining long-term shark research in San Francisco Bay while creating pathways for community members to develop field skills and engage in local marine science. Her work is defined not only by the science she produces, but by the community she is building around it, one that reflects the full diversity of people who care about our oceans. Welcome to the show,
nice.
Megan.
Great bio.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
She's pretty rad.
Thank you. Hi, everybody.
Super excited to have you on. People have suggested your name through the last 6 years, so it's really excited to have you on.
Yeah, I feel like you've been in the grapevine for a while here. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. People talk about you.
Oh,
all,
wow.
All
okay.
Good things. All good things.
Totally, right?
Very cool.
Yeah, let's start at the beginning. Were sharks always your passion, or was there a moment that kind of like pulled you into this world?
Yeah, really good question. My path has been kind of all over the place, to be honest. Marine science in general is not a very straight, linear path. It kind of goes it's like a spider web.
Did it start with birds?
No, it did not start with birds.
I joke that that's a gateway science sometimes. So,
no, it did start with marine mammals, though.
Another sexy one. Yeah.
Yeah, I originally thought I was going to be a whale biologist. But yeah, I've studied like a lot of different things. In my undergrad, I was looking at, you know, sculpin and little tidepool fishes. My master's work was actually in cephalopods. So I studied giant Pacific octopus. And then my PhD, I really switched to something else that helped me diversify and get really solid skills in field work. So to be honest with you, like my career really started at public aquariums. And the reason why my research interest is so diverse is because I had a ton of different species that I had the opportunity to work with. I was getting going to grad school to help me better my job at the aquarium. And I had my previous or like initial work had been a lot in cephalopods. If I really wanted to lead a team at the aquarium to do diverse research, I needed to get some better field skills. So that the shark was just a really good candidate because we are right in San Francisco Bay. There's tons of sharks in San Francisco Bay and no one really studying them.
Interesting.
Not at all. It's a wide open field.
I know. We had someone on to talk about leopard sharks, actually. Excuse me. And that's when your name first came on, you know, because we're like just struggling to find people that do any kind of research. It was like leopard sharks and white sharks and then your research on seven gills and some other stuff around here and not a whole lot others.
It's interesting that there's, for such a, I guess on a marine mammal that's larger on the scale of, you know, critters in the water, I'm surprised that there's lacking, you know.
And so prolific. We see them like on the water all the time when we're outside.
Right. I mean, and a huge part of that is just funding, you know, what are people's interests in? And, you know, where people interact with sharks a lot is really white sharks, right? Like people are surfing, the white sharks are where the surfers are. And so that's really where there's a lot of public interest to study sharks. A lot of the species in San Francisco Bay, you're never really going to see unless they wash up or unless you're actually going out fishing. And so they're less of a priority and less of a public interest because you don't really see them.
Well, let's paint the picture of what types of sharks are in San Francisco Bay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of different species. I would say that there's probably five that I would say are regular shark species in the bay, and then several other ray and skate species. So we have the broad-nosed seven-gill shark. That's our apex predator, and they pup here. We also have the soupfin shark. They really come in seasonally.
Soupfin?
Mm-hmm. Soupfin, also known as the schooling shark or the taupe shark. Yeah. Lots of different common names for them. But the common one that a lot of people, especially anglers, know is...
Oh, we have a Zoom pause.
Yeah, the anticipation is building.
Dun, 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 dun. Let's see if it
resolves
itself.
If not,
I'd never heard of the soupfin shark before.
Yeah, I've heard of them. I haven't seen it in Tomales Bay personally myself. We might be able to take a real quick break, and we'll just see if we can't get Megan back on with Zoom, because sometimes technology doesn't always cooperate.
Yeah, I see a frozen face there on the screen, so we'll be right back.
We do have a song queued up, right?
Not quite, but I could get there in a second.
Yeah.
I'll queue it up in a moment. I'm going to go to something else and...
I can talk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we are back after some...
a little moment of zen there.
Chanting.
You know, it's always when you're doing something important that the internet decides to just crap out.
Totally. We went over to our pre-recorded music, and luckily it was a minute of zen, so it's actually perfect.
Okay, beautiful.
Yeah. All right, we were talking about the soup
sharks.
Fin and the shark, the
soup
school
fins.
Shark, which I was showing Seamus a photo of, because I don't think he's ever seen one before.
Yeah, never. I haven't seen that one.
Yeah, it's not as common here in Tomales Bay for us to see them. I'm sure they're there.
Yeah, they're super cool. They're one of my favorites for sure.
What about thresher sharks? Do they make their way into San Francisco Bay?
Yeah, so we do have threshers. They come in the bay a little bit, as do white sharks. But in general, the bay is a little too fresh for them. It's not salty enough. So they don't stick around. So I see fishermen get the threshers as bycatch every once in a while. Mm-hmm. White sharks is less common to catch on a line. They do come in, but they just don't stick around.
Okay. You know, actually, one question about thresher sharks, maybe you can answer, because I've always been curious. Because we get them in Tomales Bay here. And we noticed over the last couple of years, it seems like anecdotally there's been more sightings of them on our end.
We had 1 year particularly that it was like the year of the thresher shark. Usually we see them more like, you know, like the start of the summer, but it was all throughout the summer you could see them jumping.
That's my question, is they like to jump. Do you know any reason or purpose for that?
You know, that's a common question we ask about a lot of species that jump out of the water, including whales and dolphins. You know, why are they jumping out of the water? Some of it might be, you know, dolphins, it might be a more efficient way to travel because there's less drag in air. But for things like whales and sharks, we think, you know, they might be doing it to help get off parasites off their skin. It also could potentially be a way of communicating with conspecifics. So if they're trying to communicate with other individuals within their same species, or if they're trying to scare something off, they might be trying to make big, loud noises to do that. It's unknown, I think. I don't know that we have, like, a for sure answer on that, and it's not something that I study.
Interesting. Okay.
I always like to think they're just having fun. I imagine them saying, like, "Wee!" as they go.
Oh, yeah. They're definitely having the absolute time of their life. They could also, like, genuinely, they could also just be doing it for fun. We have no idea.
Yeah, totally.
There could be a lot of different reasons for it.
It seemed like it was that species in particular that out here that was loved to launch itself out of the water. And they're like almost all tail, you know?
Yes. They're so cool. They're a bucket list species for me. I haven't actually worked directly with them yet.
Oh, well, come on out to Tomales Bay. We'll show you around. They're out here.
Yeah, you got it. I would love to.
What others? Any other species we didn't go over that I'm trying to think of?
You sort of stopped at soup fin. So,
yeah, okay.
Yeah, totally.
I wondered where I lost you.
It was soup fin.
Did you hear the Pacific spiny dogfish?
No,
but those are cool too.
Cool. So we have Pacific spiny dogfish is super common, especially in the summer months. Then we have the brown smoothhound and the leopard sharks. They're super abundant, super common in the bay. And then we have a bunch of ray and skate species too, like the California bat ray, the big skate, the shovel-nosed guitar fish, the thornback ray, and we even have electric rays, although I haven't seen them, but supposedly they're nocturnal, so I probably need to be fishing for them at night if I want to get those.
Okay.
Nocturnal. Or where do they go to during the day?
Wow. They sleep.
Yeah.
Oh, they sleep.
They just chill.
Yeah. We're out at nighttime doing bioluminescence tours, and it's always cool, like the different characters, cast of characters you see at nighttime.
Yeah, it's super cool. It's really interesting. I mean, shark behavior can change so much based on time of day, too.
Yeah.
Is it a myth sharks have to keep moving?
It's not a myth. Yeah. There are some shark species that do need to do that. They're called ram ventilators. They literally have to ram their gills across water to be able to ventilate. So that's things like the white shark, for example, is a ram ventilator. But then there are buccal pumpers that pump their gills so that they can actually sit still and pump water over their gills. And then there's species that kind of do an in-between thing, like seven gills in particular do this kind of weird in-between thing where they are doing a little bit of buccal pumping, but they are also considered obligate ram ventilators.
Interesting. I never heard that term before, obligate ram ventilators.
Yeah.
It's a good band name.
Hey, that is a good band name.
And so obligate RAM ventilators are where they have to move to ventilate their...
I mean, all the words are there.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, for sure.
One of the reasons why we don't have, like, white
trash. Just summing it up for our listeners.
Yeah, totally. But one of the main reasons why we don't have, like, white sharks in aquariums, right? I know they've tried in the past and even tried to get, like, the water where it's constantly flowing, but it just doesn't really quite work.
It does work. We definitely can, like, black tip reef sharks are an obligate RAM ventilator, I'm pretty sure, and they're, like, one of the most common aquarium species.
Oh, okay.
The thing with white sharks is that they just get so big, and they grow really fast, and they also swim really fast, and they start running into everything.
Yeah.
So you really just need, like, a huge, huge, massive exhibit to be able to allow there to be enough space for something like a white shark.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Good to know.
You mentioned the salinity level of San Francisco Bay. Is it it's generally less salty than – obviously there's like freshwater inflow. But like a place like Tamales Bay out here gets saltier than the ocean in the summer. And I guess you don't have that same phenomena for much of San Francisco Bay, so it stays less salty than the ocean, huh? Mm-hmm.
Typically it's always less salty. Yeah. We have a lot of freshwater influence, especially coming from the Sacramento-San Joaquin delta coming in from the north.
Right.
Yeah, so really high freshwater influence. Usually the ocean is like, what, 35 parts per thousand salinity. I have seen it get down to 8 parts per thousand in San Francisco Bay.
Oh, wow. That is a significant difference, it seems.
But
like.
that's during like a lot of heavy rain. Typically, like right now, I'm sitting between 25 and 30 parts per thousand.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
So you mentioned a lot of these sharks will use the bay as a nursery. Is that true for the majority of species that come in here, or is how does that work with the different species and utilizing the bay resources?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's one of the biggest things I'm trying to figure out.
Okay,
we know there are there's some good documentation of leopard sharks and brown smoothhounds using the bay as a nursery area. And there's documentation of broad-nosed seven-gill sharks having pups here since there were shark derbies, actually, where people would have tournaments for sharks back in the 40s and 50s. But there are other species that are definitely pupping here that we are completely undocumented, and we haven't really identified where they are, when they are, why they're there. So things like bat rays are definitely pupping here, big skates, shovel-nosed guitar fish, thornback rays, potentially there's been a little bit of a record. There's like a one mentioned sentence in the historical literature that Sufins maybe had pups here at one point. I don't know if I believe that for sure. They could have also been maybe mixed up with brown smoothhounds because they look very, very similar.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
I get that. You know, sometimes the seven gills, people are like, I got a baby white shark. I'm like, well, are you sure?
Right. Yeah, or getting an ocean sunfish and thinking it's a whale.
Is there specific like conditions that attract some of these sharks to San Francisco Bay in particular for being a nursery or pupping here?
Yeah. So in general, there's kind of an assumption or an idea that when sharks want to use, well, some species of sharks like to use protected habitat for reproduction. And so it's likely a rich nursery habitat for these species in San Francisco Bay, because the bay actually averages 15 feet across the entire bay. People don't realize that. They think it's a super deep bay, but it's really shallow. Yeah. It was historically covered in eelgrass beds. It was really rich with phytoplankton and feeder fish, game fish, and salmon, things like that. Really rich in food, and it's also protected from the open ocean. And there's also a thought that some species like to have their young in warmer areas because warm water might increase their metabolism, and therefore they can grow faster. Mm-hmm. So they can get out of that tiny little pup phase faster. So it's San Francisco Bay is this massive bay that's really, really protected. There's only one little gate coming into the bay. So it's really protected from open ocean. There's really diverse terrain in the bay. So a lot of the babies tend to be in really shallow habitat where the large adults can't necessarily access. And so that's another thing that's advantageous, right? Is if the pups can be somewhere where the adults can't, that protects them because sharks definitely eat sharks.
Oh, yeah. Mm. Yeah, yeah. Oh, interesting. Yeah, they're protected by the mud flats, intertidal zones, some of the areas with the larger... Oh. Right.
Yeah, exactly.
It also sounds like there's a lot of parallel with Tamales Bay and San Francisco Bay, where it seems like some of the species that come in here, like the bat rays and leopard sharks, seem to come in when it's warmer and you know, it's nutrient rich and protected. You know, and
bays are good for that in general. You know, and that's not all shark species. Like some will pup in really deep habitats or open ocean, and that's just part of their life history. But the species that we see here in the bay really like that shallow protected habitat for their pups.
So how are you like gathering this data and tracking it and that sort of thing?
Yeah.
So we are primarily fishing with rod and reel. So just like hook and line going out like you did growing up with your dad.
Oh, really?
Yeah, just really heavy tackle, much heavier than what I typically used to do for rainbow trout. So big, heavy rod and reel. And then I have a research vessel that was very kindly donated to me for this research. And we take the boat out and we fish for sharks on rod and reel. We bring them up on the boat. And then we have a pipe that we put in their mouth that's flushing salt water into their mouth and going over their gills. So they're able to breathe the whole time that they're on board while we're working them up.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
This is female researcher stuff. Like, how do we care for this animal while we're getting the information? I love that.
Right. That's my biggest concern. Yeah. And because, you know, my background was in public aquariums and the goal there is to keep animals alive and healthy and lower the stress as much as possible. And that definitely carries over in my field work. So we have really strict handling protocols. I do things really conservatively. One, because it helps keep the animals as, you know, as healthy and as good as possible, but it also keeps the crew as safe as possible. And that's what allows me to bring community members out with me to come fishing, and they participate in the whole thing. And they're able to because we have a very conservative program that keeps the animals and the people safe.
That's awesome.
That is really cool.
Right.
So, sharks. I assume that's the main way to track and do you tag the animals?
So I do have some tags. My seven gill sharks right now, I'm tagging with, they're called a Floyd tag or spaghetti tag or conventional tag. Mm-hmm. It's just a little stainless anchor that goes into their dorsal fin. And then this little tag comes on the outside of the body that has a phone number and an ID for the animal. So other people have to then fish that animal and then call me and say, this is where I found this animal, for me to know if it was recaptured. I am absolutely working towards getting a bunch of acoustic tags, but those are extremely cost prohibitive. Mm-hmm. And we are starting, you know, small and going from there. So acoustic tags is in the future, but not yet.
How often does that happen when someone will call you and be like, hey, I got that shark?
Yeah, it's a good question. It doesn't happen very often, but when it does, it's really exciting.
Yeah.
We have, like, our recapture rate varies between 10 and 15%. So, you know, if we put 100 tags out, we get 10 to 15 calls for that 100 animals.
That's a lot more than I thought it would
be. That seems pretty good.
Yeah, it's not bad at all. Most of them, I will say, have been recaptured in San Francisco Bay. But we get really cool recaptures pretty far south, actually. One of our large seven-gill sharks went all the way down to southern Baja California. So they're definitely making large movements from San Francisco Bay. We just don't know if the whole population is doing it, if it's an organized movement, or if it's random one-offs, or just a couple sharks wanting to go to Mexico for a nice warm vacation. We have no idea. So those are all big questions that we're still trying to answer, hopefully with more funding in the future.
That's what I was just thinking. I was like, girl, you need these acoustic tags. Like,
I know. We really do. And the West Coast in general, I would say, is really up and coming in terms of shark research. We have a lot more foundation being kind of installed in the West Coast, including this organization called IMPACT, which basically organizes all of the receiver arrays along the entire coastline. So if somebody else has receiver arrays in San Diego, they are uploading all the animals that get pinged off of their buoys from the acoustic tags, without having to like find me directly. And I can just go log in and say, oh, look, my animal has pinged off of all of these people's receiver arrays. And so we're finally just like building this huge foundation so that all of us shark researchers can start communicating along the entire West Coast.
That's awesome. That reminds me of back to the birds, the MODIS. I forget what that stands for, but All Hands Ecology has a couple like little radio towers. So any of the birds that have been tagged, it just odd. And it's like in collaboration, I think, with Canada and Mexico. And so that all goes into one database. So if they fly past, you know, Tom's Point on Tomales Bay, it's noted in that whole big system. So that's awesome that there's a thing like that for sharks.
Yeah.
Getting started.
Yeah, it's very helpful. Yeah.
It's exciting for the future because it gains so much more data that way than having exactly. to look out for them.
Yeah, collaborating and working together is the best way to get as much data as possible, for yeah. sure.
Yep. Which actually leads me to my next question is, what are some of the key data points? It sounds like right. a movement of the sharks, right? Kind of where they're going, when.
Yeah.
But what are some of those key data points you're really trying to get after?
Yeah, so really the big questions that I'm trying to answer in San Francisco Bay is who's here, why are they here, when are they here, and what abundance? So just like getting seasonality and age class and species and timing and all of those baseline things that we yeah. don't really have a strong understanding of. And we have a little bit, we have some historical data, but seasonality, for example, hasn't really been done since, I think, 1984 any of the shark species in San Francisco yeah. Bay. That was the last composition project that was done on sharks in San Francisco. So getting just like baseline information, seeing how that's changed over time. And then I like to do a lot of like physiology type stuff. So getting baselines of what their blood is supposed to look like, for example, like just like when humans go to the doctor can tell you if your blood is within parameters or not, because we have these things called reference intervals for humans. So we know if you're out of parameters, but that's very species specific. And we don't have reference intervals for any of the species in San Francisco Bay. It can also be really geographically specific. So we're just trying to get like baseline yeah. parameters, what all of these species are supposed to look like. So we can even identify if there is a problem or if they are out of parameters. And then there's lots of little offshoot studies that are constantly moving based on funding and resources sure. and collaborations. But contaminants is another big thing that we're looking at, how contaminants are affecting them, especially as they grow, because this does seem to be a reproductive rich area for these species. And so how is contaminants affecting their ability to develop and grow and survive? Those are really big questions. And then how are things like El Niños, like what we're dealing with right now, how yeah. is that going to affect the bay, especially when this bay averages 15 feet and an El Niño comes and it really warms up? What happens if it goes out of their temperature parameters? Do they leave the bay and get to colder, deeper water, or do they stay and die? And if they do go to colder, deeper water, then they're putting themselves at risk, right? Because they're leaving that protected shallow habitat. So getting a lot of just like understandings of what they are, why they're here, what they need, and what some of the biggest threats are to like compromising those things that they need.
Wow. I'm so surprised this is kind of still a frontier for the San Francisco Bay. That data it's awesome that this is the mission of a lot of what you're looking at. But like, I'm just surprised it hasn't been being covered.
I know, it really hasn't. There has been, and to be clear, there has been studies on this in San Francisco Bay, but it's extremely outdated.
Right.
Yeah. And it's been like really partitioned. Like I think one of the first seasonal studies of like what sharks looked like in San Francisco Bay was in the 70s, and it was just brown smoothhounds, and it was the very, very southern tip of San Francisco, like down by San Jose. Whereas other species like Dr. Dave Ebert did one of the last big assessments of sharks in San Francisco Bay. That was in 1984. And he did all of the species, but it was not necessarily across the entire bay. It was around a few sites in the Central Bay and the northern of the South Bay. But that was the last assessment, and that was in 1984.
Wow.
So things are definitely changing.
Such important and foundational data you're collecting here.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
A lot can change.
We're starting with baseline and then going to all the exciting stuff.
Well, we got to take a quick break here, and we'll play a little tune. If you're just tuning in, this is the Westburn Naturalist Hour on KWMR, 90.5 Point Reyes Station, 89.9 Bolinas, and 92.3 San Geronimo Valley. We are talking. It's all about sharks today, people. It's been exciting.
With Dr. Megan Holst.
Yeah. Indeed. So
before we go off, I think Liz has a mention.
I have to read some stuff.
Let the world know.
Yeah. The world. Yeah, this
the
is
world,
a good one.
The world must know.
The world must know about Inverness Park Market. Oh, we were just there this morning. KWMR is underwritten by the Inverness Park Market and Tap Room, serving the folks of West Marin for over 40 years. More information at invernessparkmarket.com.
Nice. I think we'll play a song by Taylor Swift.
This is our first Taylor Swift song we played in this.
Are you sure? I feel like we might have played a Taylor Swift song.
We played remember. Billie Eilish, but we didn't do Taylor Swift. So I'm really excited for the first Taylor Swift song here.
And it's I Did Something Bad?
Mm-hmm.
Is that the, yeah. Any context?
Because she's a big, bad shark researcher.
Yeah.
Well, and? Megan, did you want to add any more
Well, context? Yeah. Oh. In general, I have an affinity to this song because a lot of, like, people are not welcomed very much in this field, like women and gender minorities and people of color in general. And this Taylor Swift song, I Did Something Bad, just kind of, to me, rings in that tone of like, they don't want me here. They think that I don't deserve to be here, but I'm going to be here anyway. And it feels really good.
Nice.
Love that.
Yeah, so that's kind of been my theme song recently.
I love it. I love that. I'm sorry that it has to be your theme song, but we're here for it.
We're here for it.
All right, sweet. Without further ado, I Did Something Bad by Taylor Swift. They tell me through. Now all he thinks about is me. I can feel the flames on my skin, crimson red paint on my lips. If a man talks shit, then I owe him nothing. I don't regret it one bit, cause he had it coming. They say I did something bad, then why's it feel so good? They say I did something bad, it wasn't feel so good.
Something bad. It wasn't feel so good. just felt so good.
Oh, man.
Oh, that gets you riled up in the morning.
I know. Did I just become a Swiftie?
You did.
That was a great song.
Yeah, that had some good energy.
Totally.
That's because Taylor Swift's amazing.
I will have to admit, I've not
spent very little time with their music. So
totally.
Well, nice. We are back. Just tune in. This is Westboro Naturalist Hour on KWMR, and we are talking sharks.
Yeah.
With Dr. Megan
Holst.
Holst. Yes.
That's it. Yes. Very guttural, you know, German, like Holst.
Holst. Yes. Dr. Holst.
We have a Wilhelm here.
Yeah. So we wanted to, as we come back into this second segment, wanted to ask, like, why do sharks matter?
Dun, dun, dun.
Right.
Oh, that's such a big and important question.
Totally.
Sharks are so critically important. First of all, they've been a part of our ecosystem for a very, very, very long time, very long millennia. Sharks have literally existed on our planet longer than trees have existed.
Wait,
on our planet.
Really?
Really.
Oh, butter me up and call me a biscuit. I didn't know that.
They're truly just like, they have figured out the blueprint of how to survive this planet.
Yeah.
Until humans. which is kind of the sad part. That's why they need our protection. But they're just these incredible species that have been here for a long time. I forgot what your question was. Oh, why sharks matter? Why sharks matter? Because they've been maintaining habitats this entire time. Mm. So especially things like apex predators. So seven-gill sharks are considered an apex predator. And they can basically control everything else in the food web. And when you remove that apex predator, it kind of shifts everything in the food web and things can go out of whack.
Yeah.
So for example, if you like that salmon, seven-gill sharks, one of their primary prey species when they're adults is seals and sea lions. And seals and sea lions prey on salmon. So if you remove seven-gill sharks, then you're going to get a huge boom in seals and sea lions and then a huge collapse in our economically important fisheries that we all care about. That's just one example.
That's a great example,
Yes, but they kind of fit in all, they're not all apex predators. A lot of sharks are actually what we call mesopredators, which are right in the middle of the food web. And those are still really important because, again, they're keeping this balance through the entire food web. That's one of the reasons.
Yeah.
But also sharks are a really big indicator of a healthy ecosystem. You have to have a lot of resources to support a healthy shark population. And so if you see them, you know that you have a lot of abundant things in your ecosystem that want to support life.
So in a lot of ways, it kind of be like a keystone species, you know, that canary in the coal mine of a whole ecological.
Exactly. Yeah. Absolutely. They can definitely be a canary in a coal mine. And they are, like apex predators in particular, they can often be considered keystone species because they can have such a catastrophic effect on the entire food web. So that's like the short answer. I could go on hours and hours of why I think that they're important, but they're really critical to our habitat. They're critical for maintaining commercially important fish species that we want to keep eating. And that's some big things right there.
And that's probably not a connection a lot of people would make, you know, with the sharks. It's almost counterintuitive a little bit, as sharks being a predator for species.
Right.
That actually, no, that helps with the fish you catch and eat every day.
But that's a smart way, especially to go about it from, like, funding your research and whatnot, right? Is like, people have to care, and we care a lot with our, you know, livelihoods and things like that. So tying it into that economic component is a really tangible way to get that point across.
Well, yes, and to be frank with you, it's the only way we get funding.
Yeah,
is to show people that it's important to people.
Yeah.
We don't really invest financially into things unless we see that it's a financial threat to humans. Mm-hmm. So by tying it to how they're important to commercially important fisheries, that's how we get people to start caring, is if you want to have sustainable fisheries, you need these sharks to be here.
Yeah.
And I imagine it's a little bit more of a challenge with funding when because humans are such a visual species. So it's like we can care about forests when we see out of control forest fires, right? It's harder in the ocean, especially with species you don't normally see on a regular basis.
Totally. I mean, I honestly, people say that about our kelp forest because we've had so much kelp forest collapse off our coastline, and people say that it's like a forest fire that people aren't paying attention to. Mm-hmm. On land, if our entire rainforest is on fire, people know about it. But when our kelp forests are collapsing, that's like an entire rainforest collapsing, but people just don't see it. Yeah. And so they don't care as much. And I honestly think that is like a lot of the shark and ray species that we have in San Francisco Bay. People don't see them, and therefore they don't care about them. Mm-hmm. There's a quote that I really love that I reference quite a lot. That's people only protect what they love. Oh. They only love what they know, and they only know what they understand, and they only understand what they see. Something like that. Yes,
I quote that nearly every episode, so I'm so happy to hear someone else use it.
I love that.
I mean, it's so true. If they don't see it, then they're never going to know about it. They're never going to learn to care about it, and they're never going to want to protect it.
Yeah.
And, you know, white sharks, they jump out of the water, and they do really flashy things, and they have interactions with humans. And so there's a huge, like, again, a public interest there. But people aren't seeing all of these huge, beautiful species at the bottom of the ocean, and therefore they're just not really caring about them. And honestly, like when I go to apply to especially international funding, one of the things that happens the most is that they say, this is not a priority species and it's not a priority area because we haven't demonstrated that there's this catastrophic need to allocate resources to them. But just because it's not been demonstrated to be a problem doesn't mean that we shouldn't be monitoring it and understanding what the baselines are, because right now we could have a catastrophic event and maybe not even fully understand or be able to recognize it.
Yeah. I can't imagine how just the location alone of San Francisco Bay isn't considered like worthy of like noteworthy, right? For that baseline research, because I just, you know, you look at our coast of California, like it's huge, right? It's such a massive habitat with so many people living right next door.
All around it.
Yeah, all around it. Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, huge urban influence, yeah.
And especially, like, we think about San Francisco Bay has, you know, in the history I've learned about it, has gone through some pretty massive ecological changes, especially from the gold rush, right? And so... And you know, you can go have a whole podcast about that alone, but it seems like an area that would be of critical importance for a lot of research on this topic. So,
yeah, I find that the Bay in general kind of falls in this weird gray area for funding. There's a lot of funding for the Sacramento San Joaquin River Delta and studying our freshwater resources and the species that rely on that freshwater resource. And there's a lot of funding that goes towards coastal marine ecosystems. There is not a lot of funding that's specific or applies to this transition area between those two habitats.
Interesting.
And the Bay tends to get kind of overlooked.
And it's a connective tissue, right, of some of the freshwater sources and the ocean.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. That would be considered a gray area.
Yeah. That is interesting. Also, you know, talking about, you know, science, I know you don't just stop at science. You also have created opportunities for other people to become part of it. Can you tell us a little bit more about the Ocean Science Expedition Academy?
Yeah. So we call it OC is the acronym. And OC started, my co-founder is Dr. Darian Satterfield, and we started OC for a couple of reasons. One, because we wanted to find a way to continue supporting this research long term. But another reason is because both of us have been pushed out in different ways in this industry. We've been pushed out of spaces. And thankfully, we're still here. We've still maintained a position within this field. But we want to create a space that feels safe and inclusive, not only for us, but for other people, and to create equitable pathways. Because right now, shark science in particular is a very pay-to-play field. You have to pay and invest a lot of money to get little opportunities of experience before you qualify for an entry-level job. And I feel really strongly that people should have access to science. I also feel really strongly that science shouldn't be happening in a vacuum. Mm-hmm. And I want the community that is surrounding the biology and the science that we're doing to be directly involved and a part of the process. So OC started to basically create opportunities for community members, any community member, and help them learn field skills while simultaneously helping us support our big research projects. So we train anybody off the street. Like, some people that come on my boat have never been on a boat before. Some of them have never been fishing before. And wow. We train them up to be boat crew and to fish for sharks. And what I tell my volunteers is, pretty much anything that you see me do on the boat, I'm happy to train and teach you how to do as well. So they are the ones helping me restrain the sharks. They're helping me take samples of the sharks, measure them, organize the samples, and then go to release the animals. So a lot of the pictures that you see, like, I'm not really in any of the pictures because I'm always taking pictures of my volunteers and I'm helping manage the data collection and all the samples and everything. But that allows for people to get this incredible opportunity yeah. where they're seeing science up close. It's literally happening in their backyard that they may have never heard about otherwise. And while they get this incredible opportunity and maybe it helps start the careers of early career people, they're helping us get our science done. So there is no paid staff on my boat. It's all volunteer run.
Wow.
Nice.
That's amazing. Yeah. Huh. Does it span... A whole gamut of demographics and
yes, yeah, whole ages. Gamut of demographics, 80 from 18 to 80 probably.
Wow.
And yeah, I would say that we have like a really high percentage of gender minorities of color, and I think that is honestly because we are very outwardly inclusive and very when I go through training with everyone, I talk about how we ensure and are very protective of psychological and emotional safety on our boat, because those things ensure that you actually have physical safety. And in terms of things like field work, when you go to remote areas, people get away with a lot of practices that aren't safe for the animals or the people, or can be very discriminatory to people, and they get away with it because you're out in the field in these remote areas where there's a little less surveillance on what's happening. So we feel really strongly that we need to create this like safe, inclusive place, which means psychological and emotional safety, not just being physically safe. Like, you know, coming back to shore and you're physically in one piece is not the goal. The goal is for you to feel enriched and like you had a safe and like an exciting experience that goes beyond just getting back in one piece.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
So if people hear this and are inspired to learn more about this program or to join and volunteer, what would be the route for them to do that?
Yes. Right now people are just emailing me. I do have like a Google form that people sign up, and then I do a call out to my volunteers. I will say I've been doing a lot more of these speaking opportunities lately, and my volunteer list is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. So I am starting to figure out how to like rotate new people in an equitable way. I'm hopefully onboarding a volunteer coordinator that will help me manage that. So there might be a little bit of a wait if people sign up. There will also very soon, any day now, we have hired someone to help us revamp our website, and there will be a sign-up link through our website, I'd say in the next month. Yeah.
Nice.
And what's the
so
website?
Either emailing me or going to our website soon.
Can you remind folks of the website again?
Yeah. It is oseascience.com, oseascience.com.
And there'll be like a donate so we can get you acoustic tags and stuff like that.
That would
on there.
Be amazing. Yes, there is a donation page. We are soon going to have an Adopt a Shark program.
Oh, cool.
We're also going to have a program.
Adopt a Shark?
Yes, you can adopt a shark and get like a little plaque and stuff. Depending on how much you donate, you can buy a shark. You can actually name a shark and have the named shark featured on our website if you adopt one of them. So all of that is coming up on our website really soon.
Oh, nice.
That's exciting.
Yeah.
You also have your we didn't mention this, but you also have your own podcast.
That's what we first heard about you.
Yeah.
Oh, really? Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah, Sharkpedia is a podcast that me and Dr. Imani Weber Schultz have been doing. We've been on a pause for the last couple of years because now Dr. Weber Schultz was finishing her PhD and we needed to take a break while she was finishing that up. But now she's finished and we're talking about bringing it back.
Oh, nice.
Oh, cool.
Stay tuned for that as well.
And you started in 2021, correct? I thought that's what.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, so right around the same time we started this show.
Yeah.
Actually. Oh, nice. Yeah. That's awesome.
During COVID, yeah, we were sitting around having conversations. Like, wouldn't it be fun? This was actually a radio show. So,
yeah,
this still happening 6 years later.
Yeah, that's awesome. It's a lot of work to keep it going.
It is.
Oh yeah. Yeah. labor of love.
It is a labor of love. Absolutely.
It is a labor of love.
Is there any other ways that people can participate or get involved?
Oh, yes. There's a few ways. One of the donation things I forgot to talk about, we're soon going to launch this thing where if you become a monthly donor, like if you donate $10 a month, you'll become part of our Shark Chat, which is a once a month like coffee hour with me, where it'll be an open hour where you get to come and hang out, ask whatever questions you want, and I'll have exclusive updates about what we did that month and stuff like that. The other thing is that Seven Gill sharks in particular are targeted quite a bit by recreational anglers. And if people do fish for them, they can take photos of the animal and measure it and sex it and submit an observation on our website really soon. Again, this is not up yet, but we're about to have this observation area where people can submit photos. It started already in Humboldt Bay, and we're trying to get people along the community to do it all along our coastline and submit photos, because we think we know we can re-identify seven gill sharks based on their spot pattern.
I was just about to ask how you would identify the shark. It's spots.
Spots. Yeah. They are super spotty. Especially if you look at the pups, they look like little Dalmatian puppies.
Oh wow. Huh.
Yeah, they're super cool. But one of the things that we're trying to figure out is if the juveniles actually retain that pattern as they grow. Once they're full grown, we know that they do seem to retain that spot pattern. But juveniles, you know, like as they grow, do those spots spread out, or like what happens there? So that's a study that we're doing right now, is seeing like, okay, if we picture all of these pups, can we see them 5 years later and still be able to re-identify them? But that's people who fish for sharks. They can submit photos, and also divers. So especially in like Southern California area, big seven gill sharks are in shallow areas. And if you're out diving and you take some underwater photos, you can definitely submit those photos.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. And then just staying connected. We're soon going to have a newsletter, and our social media just started. So if people want to share our stories from social media, that's always very helpful to get our name out there. But those are some of the easiest ways to get involved. And then, of course, like becoming a volunteer and actually coming fishing with me.
Yeah.
I also need volunteers for things like, you know, if you have a special service that you can donate to the organization, like helping me with my taxes or like helping me fix our website or helping me, I don't know, with you name it. What is your special skill that I don't have because I'm just a scientist trying to run a company? I will always accept help.
Speaking of diving, you mentioned diving. Is that utilized at all for observing sharks in San Francisco Bay, or is it mainly
from
fishing for them?
Yeah. No, it's just fishing for them. I always say San Francisco Bay is a bay of chocolate milk. You can't really see through it, so it's honestly not really safe to dive in here, especially with how the gate is. Our currents that come in and out of San Francisco Bay are really strong.
Oh, yeah, it's super dynamic there. Yeah.
It's super dynamic, and there's not a lot to see. So people typically don't dive here unless they absolutely have to.
Gotcha.
To, like, go maintenance something.
Gotcha.
Well,
unfortunately, yeah.
And so what's next? What's next in your research?
What's next?
Yeah.
Da, da, da.
Great question. You know, what's next is that we're really just trying to get some sustainable sources of financial stability so that we can keep growing and hire some of our first employees and keep this work running long term. So right now, I think this year is about investing and getting OC as like a running, functioning machine. And then future years are just going to be figuring out how to maintain that and grow that from there. And then publishing as many papers as possible from all the work that we're doing so we can demonstrate how much cool work is happening out of San Francisco Bay.
Nice.
I love that. For folks, one last time, can you give them the website where they can donate again?
Yeah, the website is oseascience.com, oseascience.com.
Fantastic.
I guess kind of any sort of in your time researching sharks out here, anything that's like some fun fact or something that's like really surprised you about some of the species you've worked with,
or the environment?
Oh,
yeah, or the environment. Yeah,
yeah, that's a good question. I mean, one thing that I just think is really cool that maybe surprised me when I first was learning about sharks is how many different modes of reproduction they have.
Oh, yeah.
They have 3 modes of reproduction. One is egg laying. So they lay those like mermaid's purses you've probably mm-hmm. heard of. Mm-hmm. And then one is live bearing, right? They give live birth just like humans. And then there's a third one that's really weird that's in between. That's a aplacental viviparous, which is they like have egg cases in the uterus, but then they hatch and give live birth.
Oh,
and
wow.
Seven gill sharks are one of those weirdos that are like the weird in between. So we actually have every mode of reproduction here in San Francisco Bay. We're hoping to soon create actually like a children's book that talks about the different types of baby sharks in San Francisco Bay and how they come to be. That's something in the works as well. We're trying to do a lot of like community outreach type curriculum building and things like that. But yeah, I think the different kinds of reproduction are really weird to me.
That's cool.
When I realized that they were all here in San Francisco Bay, I was like, that is so cool. Awesome. Where else does that happen where we have all 3 right there?
Right.
Again, like that alone is worth the funding to keep this research going, like finding things out like that, right?
Well, it's about time we should wrap up. But Megan, this has been super inspiring. It's so cool to hear you doing such foundational research in San Francisco Bay and all this really cool projects you're working on.
Yeah. So. Yeah, thank you guys so much for having me. It was awesome to talk to you guys finally.
Yeah, hopefully we'll get a chance to join you on the boat someday.
Yes,
oh,
please.
Yeah,
reach out.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Come on out. I'd love to have you.
All right, well, have a great rest of your day.
Yeah, you guys too.
Do we have some music to go out on here?
Yeah. Beyonce? Yeah. Isn't there a Beyonce song? What's a good Beyonce song?
Girls.
Girls.
That's right, exactly.
All right, let's do it. It's right here. I got it.
Pump it up this morning.
Yeah. Girl power hour.
I love it.
Good way to start a Monday.
They got great beats, too.
All right. We'll see you all in a few weeks. Thanks, Megan.
Thanks, Megan.
All right, thank you, guys. Bye. Girls, we run this motherfucker.